Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour here, as soon as we get hooked up with our guest, we expect to be talking with Dr. Deborah Davis. She's director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. She's also professor in the Department of Epidemiology at the Graduate School of Public Health. And we'll be talking with her about cancer and about our efforts to deal with cancer and some of what you will find in her new book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, in which she makes the basic argument that we have concentrated perhaps too much on treating cancer. She might not say we've concentrated too much, but she certainly would say that we have not done what we can do or could do to deal with the issue of prevention. For much of its history, the war on cancer has indeed concentrated on detecting, treating, and curing disease. The problem, says Dr. Davis, is that we have left off the table all the things that can cause cancer. The result, she argues, has been millions of preventable cancer deaths over the last 30 years. Her book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, looks at the ways that research on prevention has been downplayed and kept from getting widespread circulation. The book is published by Basic Books. Let me again tell you just a little bit more about her. As I mentioned, she's director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. She is an environmental advisor to Newsweek. She was founding director of the Board on Environmental Studies and Toxicology of the National Academy of Sciences. She also serves as a scholar in residence at the National Academy of Science. Her previous book, When Smoke Ran Like Water, was a finalist for the National Book Award in nonfiction. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome, as always. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along. But, of course, people who are listening can call in. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Davis, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
I'm delighted to be here.
Great, well, we appreciate you giving us your time. Just to begin, as far as cancer is concerned, we have, it seems, in a sense, kind of a good news, bad news situation, at least in that, on the one hand, our ability to treat cancer has indeed improved. So that means we have a lot of people who have survived cancer. On the other hand, the incidence of cancer rates are increasing.
Well, as a matter of fact, incidence is even going down overall because fewer people are smoking. Mm-hmm. But the reality is for certain types of cancer not related to smoking and not related to screening, like breast, colorectal, and prostate, we are seeing an increase in incidence. And in addition, in most cases, we have no idea why a person gets cancer when we exclude the cancers known to be associated with smoking.
I guess I'll give you an opportunity to talk about what here is indeed your bottom line, and that is that while we put lots of resources into treatment, we have not put as much in that we should have into prevention.
Yeah, and it's not like a simple either-or situation because a lot of the basic research that we do is relevant to prevention. Just as an example, the National Cancer Institute itself has for years produced studies that show that pesticides increase the risk of certain cancers, particularly in farmers and their families. And despite the fact that the National Cancer Institute has produced an impressive body of evidence on this, the U.S. EPA has not acted on that evidence in the ways that I think that they could. And that's an example of this paradox where we actually do have a lot of information from basic research, but we haven't put it into public policy domain.
Mm-hmm. You make the argument in the book that at least as far back as the 1930s, that there was a good body of scientific knowledge that showed that particularly environmental exposure to certain things, especially in the workplace, were very important in causing cancer. And you write about them, and I'm sure we can talk about some of these things in detail, things like benzene or asbestos.
Absolutely.
Or other things that people might be exposed to, radiation, for example, and, of course, smoking.
Yeah.
And that you also did, on the other hand, say that now we still have this this problem where in some cases someone gets cancer and we can't, you know, if someone gets lung cancer and they were a heavy smoker, we can say, well, we pretty much think we understand that. And if they had significant industrial exposure, say they worked around asbestos and they developed cancer, maybe we might say, well, we pretty much know what that is about. How, I guess I'm going back to this idea that there still, though, are there are some things that are known carcinogens. On the other hand, there are cases where we simply have to kind of throw up our hands with individual cases and say, well, we really don't know why this particular person got cancer.
That's right. For example, in 1 out of 10 women who get breast cancer, we know they inherited a defect in their genes. Mm-hmm. But that means that most women who got breast cancer are born with healthy genes, but something gives them the disease. Something happens in the course of their lifetime to cause the disease to occur. We know that identical twins, who are as close to a clone as we have in human nature because they come from one egg that splits into two embryos fertilized by the same sperm, identical twins do not get the same cancer. And when people move to the United States from Asia, within 2 generations, their risk of breast and prostate cancer is that of the United States, and not the lower risk, which is 4 to 5 times lower in Asia than in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that a good, clear case for the issue of there being a known carcinogen and good evidence to believe there that it was implicated in cancer, and that people who were interested, who had interest to protect, were downplaying. It seems like a good case study is indeed tobacco.
It is a good case study, and the reality is we knew enough to take action against tobacco in the 1940s, in the 1930s, frankly. Now, the question is, what was evidence? What was considered proof of harm? And that's where it's been a kind of subtle shift. In the 1936 International Congress that I found in researching my book, the world's leading scientists in 1936 concluded that there were a number of clear causes of cancer, including, by the way, radiation, sunlight, cobalt and uranium mining, coal tars, synthetic hormones, and benzene, among others. And yet, what was considered evidence in 1936 is not what we consider evidence today, and that's because the nature of proof required has shifted with the political and economic realities. Now, Illinois has a famous pioneer in this work, Dr. Samuel Epstein, who has for years documented the perverse relationships between a number of industries and the cancer establishment. It's actually become more insidious nowadays because sometimes the same company at a very high level has parts of that company that produce a pesticide or a chemical, and another part of the same company produces drugs to treat cancer.
Mm-hmm. Is it the case, and I guess I ask this question knowing the answer, that we have been held back, and particularly when it comes to prevention, because there are interests here that are involved in producing carcinogens that, as clearly seems to be the case with the tobacco industry, we're interested in, at the very least, muddying the waters, creating doubt in people's minds whether indeed these things were a threat to health?
You know, I think that that has been the case for some companies in the past, and I can only hope that the Internet is changing the ability of people to withhold information and to confuse people. It's making it harder, but not impossible, to suppress information about the hazards of materials.
How well are we doing in now trying to address the issue of workplace exposure to known carcinogens?
The story of workplace cancer causes is an appalling story in the United States of America today. The budget for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the budget for many of the institutions that we think are supposed to protect our workers, is at an all-time historic low. We do not have enough toxicologists within the FDA to evaluate reports of hazards. We don't have enough people in the National Institutes of Occupational Safety and Health to do studies on workers. We don't even have good information about exposures of workers today. Now, the irony is that with modernization and globalization, what we have done in many cases is to ship the more hazardous industries offshore. And as a consequence, American workers now have a smaller proportion who are working in blue-collar jobs than at any time in our history, in our modern history. So our workforce may have less exposure on a global population basis, but that does not mean that individual workers are not still highly exposed to materials that can be very damaging to their health. And we just don't even have the resources now to document this. The major companies at this point are generally cleaner than they've been. They're highly mechanized. Just as an example, IBM now, if they make any materials in the United States, generally uses robots to make them through something called lights out manufacturing. But 20 or 30 years ago, they had so-called clean rooms in which workers worked, and they could be exposed to, I think, dangerous levels of chemicals, which we have not been able to document because of the perverse incentives that operate for companies to withhold information, and because the legal system really isn't working very well on any side, neither for plaintiffs nor defendants.
But it seems that the kind of impact on workers, what's happened is that it hasn't gone away. It's just been shifted.
It's been shifted outside of the country. Yeah. That's one thing. I mean, look at China right now, where there are certain villages that the Chinese official press confirms 80% of the people are dying of cancer, and it's not because of smoking. Now, if the Chinese government is confirming this, that should give us all pause.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Devra Davis. She is director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. She's also a professor in the Department of Epidemiology in the Graduate School of Public Health. She is the author of a recently published book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. It's published by Basic Books, in which she makes the argument that, well, indeed, we have made progress in treating cancer, that we have not done what we can do or should do in dealing with the causes of cancer. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And we'll start out here talking with somebody who is listening. Someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. Dr. Davis, nice to speak with you.
Nice to speak to you.
My question is that we have a situation here locally where we had an old coal-to-gas manufacturing plant in one of the lower-income neighborhoods, and there were tons of coal tar left there for many years. What are some of the things that we can expect to be a result health-wise from that? As we have also, we see a form of aggressive cancers in a cluster in that area. I just wanted you to elaborate on some of the things about coal tar and benzene.
Well, coal tar residues can be found in chimneys of homes like the one I grew up in early on in Denora that were heated with coal. But coal tar pitch is really full of a number of highly toxic materials, some of which are known to cause cancer. If it contains creosote, then we know that creosote is very damaging, and a mixture of dark brown and black residues that come from the distillation of coal. It's kind of what's left over after you've baked it all out. And when you're in the process of making this stuff, you, of course, have a lot of gases that come out of it. What you're left with, is this a solid or a liquid or just dust?
Well, it was a, from what we understand, a black viscous type of liquid underground.
Well, then in that case, it's probably going to be have a number of things in it, including benzene, benzopyrene, and a bunch of what are called VOCs, volatile organic compounds, but they can be wrapped up in the liquid so that they remain there. Is it getting into the groundwater?
Yes, the groundwater is contaminated underneath the surface, and it's spreading out.
I see. And what's the name of the community?
This is the north end of Champaign, basically.
The north end of Champaign.
Yes.
And has the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry been there?
Well, I'm not sure about that. We've been in contact with the city, and we've been in contact with Ameren, who now owns the property, and we know that there was an attempt for a cleanup in 1997, but there's still evidence of these substances on the site and contamination of the groundwater heavily in that area.
Well, is the groundwater used for drinking?
Right now, no. They've stopped all. No one's using that water in that area, the groundwater, for drinking, no.
But was it previously?
that we're still researching. We're trying to find out how long.
Because, you see, you have to have, you know, it's bad to have coal tar residue where there's general exposure. But if it's in the water and people aren't exposed to the drink to it through drinking water, then that's a good thing. Obviously, you would want to make sure of that. The problem we face in trying to understand the environmental causes of cancer is that life is a mixture. And the gold standard for understanding causation is a clinical trial where you take people with a disease and you give them a drug, you take another group of people with the same disease and you give them a placebo that's not the drug, and you look at the end of the trial to see whether or not there's a difference. And that's the gold standard. That's done with one compound at a time. Mm-hmm. Life is a mixture, and we don't have that luxury. And often in poor neighborhoods, you've got other health problems, including poor diets, unemployment, which poverty itself is considered a carcinogen. And when you add all of these things together, you're really adding insult to injury. And one of the things that I argue in my book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, is that we should not insist that proof must consist of statistically significant numbers of people, all of whom are found to have a given disease with a given exposure in a specific time. Because that level of proof is very difficult to meet. And that's why what we need to do in cases involving environmental contamination is first identify the contamination enough to know whether we should clean it up or move people out. And that has to be the way we look at the question, instead of do we have evidence that enough people are sick or dead that we can show that there's harm. And I think that's a very big challenge for all of us in our society today, because the people who bear the burden of pollution are usually not the ones who had anything to do with making it or profiting it from it.
Right. And quickly, one last thing is, could you, or have you been able to identify some of the direct links or any of the proposed types of cancer or other health defects that come from exposure to benzene coal tar?
Well, as I just indicated to you, it's very difficult. But in the case of benzene, there's a very well-established literature linking benzene to forms of leukemia. Benzene is also implicated as a cause of breast cancer. And benzene has the property that it's a very good solvent. It slices right through oil, and it slices right through human skin and bone.
All right, well, I hope that gets to the questions of the caller. Let's go on and talk with someone else. This is Champagne, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
My question is rather related to the previous callers, but can you tell me if you know who owns the site, like, for instance, the one just previously mentioned, do they have a legal responsibility to monitor, like, say, windborne pollution off of that site, or do they have no legal responsibility to do that, or do they?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and of course I'm not a lawyer. The laws are one set of issues, but here's what I want to say to everybody listening. There's a four-letter word we have to think about, and that's vote. Right now, no matter what the laws say, we have many examples where the federal government has not been implementing and enforcing the existing laws. I can't answer your question of whether there is a legal mandate to monitor off-site pollution. But whether or not there's a legal mandate, there's a moral mandate, isn't there?
Well, I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. So for example, you've got companies in Champaign area, like Mobil and New Jersey Zinc, that have been studied for years in terms of the contamination in the area. And there have been plans to monitor the blood and urine of people who live near the site to determine if it was necessary to stop contamination. And that's the way that EPA has been acting. Let's check the people to see if there's a problem. I understand that approach, but I think a better approach is to prevent the pollution and to contain it in the first place. And we need to do both. We obviously need to continue to do the basic research to understand issues like the allegation that there might be an elevated level of multiple sclerosis associated with some of this contamination. But at the same time, we need to do a better job of containing pollutants rather than trying to prove harm has already happened.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think an approach to a problem like that would be illegal, like a suit?
Oh no, I can't possibly advise you about such matters, both for my own sake as well. I will say this. often the only things that have led to reform on the environment have been lawsuits. And unfortunately, I do not think that that's a good comment on our democracy at this point. And in my book, I actually call for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Toxic Hazards, because I think that lawsuits often don't work. And right now, they're heavily weighted against plaintiffs, against people who are alleging injury, because of a series of Supreme Court decisions which have basically made it more and more difficult for people who are alleging harm to receive compensation for those allegations. That has nothing to do with whether or not they've really been harmed. It has to do with the fact that we are now seeing the full flower of the courts that have been appointed that are increasingly conservative when it comes to decisions that they make about what sorts of evidence is sufficient to take action on.
All right. We have another caller here. Thank the last person. Go to Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Sir? Is that me?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. I want to go back to the issue of the coal tar and benzene in Champaign, Illinois, because there are two other characteristics of the community that are troublesome, even if the drinking water does not come from the groundwater. One is that the water pipes in that area for many, many years, and some of them probably still now, are very, they're clay, and they've gotten very old, and there can be cracks in those water pipes.
Uh-huh.
So the groundwater can get into pipes, even if it's not the main source of drinking water. The second thing is that Champaign, Illinois, sits on an area that had been swamp, and many of the basements tend to flood, and thus water from the water table has, over the years, gotten into many, many of the houses in this area. What are the health risks from those two considerations?
Well, I thank you for this clarification. Obviously, I'm not an expert on this particular site, but you're absolutely right. Where cracks occur in old pipes and the water infrastructure in the United States in some cities can be over 100 years old, then there's a possibility for contamination from groundwater into the water. And then there are also other issues relating to off-gassing that might occur. And if the soil is disturbed, how deeply does this material go into the soil? What is the depth of the water table? For example, in Long Island, there are areas where the water table is at the ground level, so that whenever there's a lot of flooding, you can get percolation of pollutants right up to the ground. Absolutely, my colleague, Dr. Evelyn Talbot, has done a very important work showing that basement contamination from leaking underground storage tanks is associated with an increased risk of cancer. And cancer takes, unfortunately, a long time to develop. I don't think we should wait for evidence of health hazard before cleaning things up. And it becomes a very challenging situation to determine the risks and benefits in any particular situation. But I gather that this contamination has been going on for a long time.
Oh, yes, a very long time.
And it becomes, as I say, because cancer takes such a long time to develop, it's very, very difficult to do the kinds of studies that often the government says, well, we're going to look into this, we'll do a study of the health damages, when in fact health damages are very difficult to prove in a situation like this. But if you can show exposure, if you can show that there is migration off-site, then there is an opportunity, I think, to either move people or figure out how to clean things up, rather than simply waiting till you can confirm that hazard has happened, harm has happened.
Yes, I'm aware of the difficulty in terms of scientific proof and causality here, but there was a public meeting this weekend in Champaign, Illinois, where residents from that area, it was held in the public library branch, it was very close to that site, residents from that area, who are, by the way, all African-American, and all poor, came and testified as to the incidences of cancer in their families over time. And those were people that lived really right next to that site. And the migration of this material, we don't have figures since, I think it was 1990, but this goes back quite far in history. And there is one migration chart that showed that in 90, it had migrated well beyond its original boundaries. Hmm. So we can presume that it's continuing to migrate.
Yes. If you have environmental measurements and you're finding migration, I think that's important. And I think that I can't comment on the specifics of the site. I can tell you, as others have commented, that coal-tar contains a number of known causes of cancer, including benzene, mm-hmm. and that people should not be directly exposed to it. At the same time, you know, modern life is a mixture, and we can't live in a bubble. So trying to organize on behalf of disadvantaged communities is a very important thing to do. In my book, I talk about the fact that when it comes to the excess of cancers in the black community in the United States today, we often immediately assume that there's some kind of genetic susceptibility. But let me tell you something. One in eight Americans is black, but one in two who works in sanitation, and one in four who lives near a hazardous waste site is black. Mm-hmm. So we have got to pay more attention to the environmental causes of poor health and especially cancer in the black community.
Thank you very much. It's very helpful.
Thank you. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. We have another caller we'll get right to. I want to introduce again our guest, Devra Davis. She's the director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. She's also a professor in the Department of Epidemiology in the Graduate School of Public Health. She was founding director of the Board on Environmental Studies and Toxicology of the National Academy of Sciences and serves as well as scholar in residence at the National Academy of Science. She is the author of a recently published book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. It's published by Basic Books, in which she makes the argument that for much of its history, what we call the war on cancer has concentrated on treating and curing and detecting the disease. The problem, she says, is that we have left off the table all of those things that we know can cause cancer.
And let me suggest
yes.
that your listeners might find more information than we can possibly cover this hour on the website for our Center for Environmental Oncology, which is preventingcancernow.org. That's preventingcancernow.org. We're really interested in giving information out to people about things they can do that they can control in their lives. We have a pamphlet that you can download on the possible role of personal care products for African Americans and others in explaining the increased rate of breast cancer in young black women as well.
All right. We have another caller here, someone in Champaign. This is line number three.
Thanks very much for taking the call, and I wanted to just wish Dr. Davis well in the excellent work. I haven't read the book, but I certainly plan. I had two questions. One is partially been, referred to, and again, it's related to the issue in Champaign. One is the support that institutions like the Center for Environmental Oncology could provide for communities like the one referenced in Champaign. The second was, and I'm intrigued by her idea of the truth and reconciliation model. I mean, she's already made reference to this, the bluntness of legal instruments. I think this sort of civil action books. And I'm familiar with Susan Steingraber's work on living downstream. So this seems, very pervasive. But to what extent would a Truth and Reconciliation Commission begin to shift the debate forward, and also the extent to which sort of environmental justice movements contribute towards some exposure, if not amelioration or compensation for these types of problems?
Well, I thank you for your kind words, and obviously we can't possibly in this short period of time go into the details of such a concept. As you know, the truth and reconciliation idea comes from South Africa, where it was a stunning example of a recognition that if you tried to punish everybody that was guilty during the period of apartheid, you would end up punishing most of the country. And in some sense, we are living out the cartoon character Pogo. We've met the enemy and it is us.
Right.
Now, some of us don't have much power, and so I'm not saying that a largely minority community that is pretty much victimized by pollution is in fact responsible for its pollution. But in many instances, there has been in the past naivete, and then more recently, just frankly, cover-ups of information about hazards. So I can't tell you how a Truth and Reconciliation Commission would work. I can simply say that the current system has created incentives for industry to just really stonewall and bring in the most expensive lawyers they can and not come forward with what they know about hazards. And if we had a neutral forum where information could be provided, mm-hmm. where they would accept their moral responsibility to pay for medical costs mm-hmm. and monitoring, mm-hmm. but not be liable to the punitive damages that they have now, that I think that this might offer us a possibility, a way out of the dilemma that we face now, because increasingly when a lawsuit is filed mm-hmm. on behalf of someone alleging damage, mm-hmm. the way the courts are going now, the burden of proof becomes almost impossible.
Right. So, I think I would agree by and large. I wanted you also to make comments on the salience of the environmental justice movement, the role of universities, and I think particularly, I mean, like your Center for Environmental Oncology,
well,
the sort of David and Goliath struggle in that point out.
Well, I thank you for that. And absolutely, the environmental justice field within the university and socially is transforming the way people understand the nature of pollution. In fact, it might properly be called environmental injustice because of the statistics I recited earlier about the profound differences in exposure to pollution of many people in minority communities throughout the United States and, in fact, globally as well. Minorities are most disadvantaged, whether they be called guest workers in Germany or the farm workers in the United States today. There is a tremendous amount of good work going on in research centers in Illinois and here in Pittsburgh, where we are determined not just to document the problem, but to come up with ways to solve it. And I would invite you to look at our website and perhaps send in notes of ways that we might be able to work with others who are out there. We in Pittsburgh right now have one example, a program here, a nonprofit called Global Links, mm-hmm. takes the unused medical supplies, which we can't use here, and sends them to El Salvador and other places where it's saving lives.
Right.
More importantly, though, we are reducing our own ecological footprint.
Okay.
We are using fewer toxic chemicals. We have a huge system here. 400 different buildings in 5 states are covered by the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, and we are committed to going green. We're working with people in the minority community to improve their job opportunities, but also to improve understanding of why it's not a good idea to spray pesticides in your own home. The university itself is committed to getting rid of its own toxic chemicals, to reducing its toxic burden on the communities around. And I think that this is the sign of the times. I mentioned this earlier. Dr. Epstein wrote his book almost now, I think, close to 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
More than that, actually. Mm-hmm. And he was way ahead of the times. The difference now is I think there are more people out there who are saying the same things. And the corporate sector understands that they will implode if they don't make fundamental changes. And I have been most encouraged by the conversations I've had with leaders of some major corporations that are going green.
Okay.
And I think that's also a welcome sign of the times. We have to be aware of greenwashing, of course, where companies claim that they're green and they're really not.
But thank you very much. And from our side, just a special point that we're trying to, at the University of Illinois, lobby to get Dr. Davis here as a guest speaker, so hopefully she can fit us in at some time in a busy teaching and lecturing schedule. And to David Inge, thanks for a wonderful program. Thank
you
very
much.
I would love to. I'm a big fan of what you guys are doing.
Well, what I want to do is take a moment here, because I'm sure that there are people who have been listening and are wondering about this very question. What is it that they, in their own lives, can do to reduce their cancer risk? And I'm sure that on the top of anybody's list would be something like, for example, smoking.
Sure.
I would say, don't smoke, and if you do, stop. That's pretty clear. Are there some other things in the that have to do with the way we live our lives where you could say, here's something that you could do, it's not all that complicated, that you could do to reduce your risk of getting cancer?
Certainly, but let me also repeat that four-letter word, vote. Because if you can't say no to a dirty, polluting power plant in your backyard. You can say no to smoking and no to too much drinking and no to dangerous sex, and those are all good things that we should do. But we've done a really good job of telling people the things they're supposed to do as individuals, and that's why often many people with cancer blame themselves, oh, my God, what did I do wrong? Sometimes you did absolutely nothing wrong, except you had the bad luck to live in the wrong place or work in the wrong job in terms of being exposed to cancer-causing agents, and or not have the freedom to choose, which we don't, where you get to work and live often because of economic factors. So what I think it's really important for people to understand is look under your own sink. If you can't understand what's on the label of something, then maybe you shouldn't be using it. And you can get rid of, for example, of ants with red pepper flakes. What you do to get rid of ants is first you find out how they're getting into your house, you clean up whatever food's attracting them, and you sprinkle red pepper flakes, as I do, around my garbage can. And your dog won't like them once, and that'll be it. They'll learn not to eat them again. But you will get rid of ants, and you don't have, and you should not be spraying indoors, certainly not in kitchens, which people don't necessarily understand. Look under your sink. Look at the products that you're using and buying in your homes. Cleaning can be done with baking soda for almost all uses that you can use cleanser for. And toothpaste cleans silver and a lot of metals. And lemon juice and boric acid powder, boric acid can repel roaches. So we have on our website, preventingcancernow.org, lots of information about things you can do and links to other organizations like thegreenguide.com, Environmental Working Group, that are giving you practical advice about things you can do. Certainly avoid sunburns, but you need 20 minutes of sunlight a day to synthesize vitamin D. And African Americans need more than 20 minutes a day because their skin is darker to get enough vitamin D. But tanning beds should be banned, in my opinion. Tanning beds are associated with an increase in skin cancer and melanoma, and my colleague here at the university, Dr. John Kirkwood, is seeing increased numbers of young people with malignant melanoma who work in tanning salons. And before the age of 17, he's seen cases of this very aggressive skin cancer. In addition, question whether you really need a CT scan. There's been a tenfold increase in CT scans in the United States in the past decade. And many of these CT scans are being given to children. If it's an emergency, if you have someone who's unconscious and you don't know what the cause of a bleed is, you may need a CAT scan. But there's a tremendous growth in the use of non-emergency CAT scans, and it's so out of control that the American College of Radiology has issued a white paper warning about the unnecessary use of CT scans.
Let me ask you one more thing really quickly, and then we'll get to some other questions. We know now that a virus, the human papilloma virus, which causes genital warts, also it's some of them, and there are a lot of them, but some of them have been implicated in cervical cancer. And we now have a vaccine, which is being given to young women to try to prevent them acquiring the virus and then that going on to develop cancer. And then, of course, there are some questions. There are a lot of questions on people's minds about should my daughter have this? At what age should she have this? If I'm an adult woman, should I have this? Should we be giving this to boys? What's your thought on this vaccine now for HPV?
I'm very concerned about HPV in two different fronts. I'm concerned that it's only being given to girls. Pardon me a second. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned that it's not being adequately monitored for adverse effects. There have been, according to some of the medical news reporters, there have been deaths in people that might have been associated with HPV vaccine. And my concern is that the vaccine was first tested on women between the ages of 15 to 25. Now, let me be clear, those deaths are not clearly associated with the vaccine, but they are something that people are following up. And more troubling to me is the fact that the HPV vaccine, which protects against four major types of HPV, was never tested in boys, and that young men who are gay, who have HPV, have a risk of transmitting an anal cancer associated with it, and there are head and neck cancers, laryngeal cancer, is associated with HPV as well. So why are we just vaccinating girls? because we think of girls as receptacles for boys. And if we are really concerned about preventing HPV-associated cancer, we should be expanding the purview, but we absolutely need to be vigilant about monitoring carefully for adverse reactions. And we have a classic example, which we've done with mammography, which we've done with PSA, where we introduce a technology broadly into the population without continued monitoring and studying of whether it makes sense. And that's something that I think we have to be careful about, because we get so over-invested in these technologies that we get committed to them without understanding whether what their risks and benefits really are.
All right, let's talk with some of the other people who are listening. Next, we will talk with someone in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. While I was waiting online, the guest touched on the subject matter of my call, which is to say that while the attempts to improve the environment are long-term enterprises, there are short-term things that we can do, including the use of vitamin D. The guest mentioned that we should get 20 minutes of sunlight a day, but of course at latitudes like the 40 degrees north where we are, after about the 1st of October, you don't get very much from sunlight, even if you're willing to go out in the chill and expose yourself. So it's necessary to take vitamin D by supplementation, since there's very little in the diet. And even conventional medicine allows that 2,000 units of vitamin D3 is safe for everybody, and it's very cheap. And especially African Americans need this supplementation, because even when they're in the sunlight, it takes like six times as long for them to get the vitamin D from sunlight. And I've been amazed in attempting to inform people about the use of vitamin D against cancer and other things, including multiple sclerosis and the flu and an amazing number of things, that even though the evidence varies from strongly suggestive to overwhelming, that doctors and others are very resistant, and I don't understand that. And perhaps the guest has something to say about it.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's been a number of articles that have shown a beneficial effect of vitamin D, including even looking at the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, where they found that people who had, they measured in their bloods, those who had the higher levels of vitamin D, that seemed to be associated with a lower risk of breast cancer. And looking at several measures of sunlight exposure and dietary vitamin D. And I think that the evidence for supplementation is pretty strong at this point. But it's the vitamin D3, which is also known as calcitriol, that seems to play a very important role in the regulation of cell growth and differentiation. I think that we will soon look back on this time of medicine and say, remember when we used to treat people for illness without asking what they were eating, where they were living, where they worked? I think that we are on the verge of a revolution in understanding the importance of diet and environment and workplace interactions. And yes, the evidence on the protective role of vitamin D for breast cancer and probably colon and prostate and probably a whole bunch of other diseases, perhaps multiple sclerosis, is growing. And it's appearing in the medical literature and peer-reviewed studies. And the challenge becomes, as a public policy issue, when do we reach the point where we should have supplementation with vitamin D3 as we do with other things in our food supply? And I think that, again, is a public policy question, which we're hoping to stimulate through the research that we're doing at the Center for Environmental Oncology and through conversations with people as informed as the person who just called in.
We just have about 5 minutes left, and I have several other callers. I'd like to try and include one or two. Just also very quickly, our guest is Dr. Deborah Davis. She's the director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. She's author of the recently published book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, published by Basic Books, in which she argues that we have not done enough in the area of prevention. The next caller up will be on our line number two in Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. The coal tar discussion, I don't want to reprise it, but I wanted to mention that there, I understand there are 27 of these farmer sites around Illinois, so people who are out in other areas can find out if they have been attended to in any way and whether they follow the pattern of being in the disadvantaged parts of town. I'm still recovering from the idea that HPV isn't being sufficiently monitored. This is Merck, after all. Merck, which just paid off. You know, anybody that says that Big Pharma isn't doing a disservice and wild damages to the polity is just needs to dwell on that for a moment. But actually, I wanted to ask you about what you said at the very beginning about a best example of exposure, and I think you're referring to atrazine, which hasn't come up on any of the water discussions, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That you could probably elaborate on that for the next hour, but could you just summarize it a bit and
sure.
Point at it? Thanks.
Atrazine is banned in Bulgaria and Sweden, and yet it's one of the most widely used pesticides in the United States today. It's been shown to have effects on reproduction. It's been shown to have effects in laboratory studies on cancer, and there's even some human data on atrazine. It's a mystery to me and to most scientists who know much about the issue as to why it continues to be approved so broadly for use in the United States today. And it's an example where the federal government really is not doing the job that we thought they should do. And I want to just paraphrase from my book. Bertolt Brecht once quipped, if the government doesn't like the people, then it should elect itself a new people. And I think this government that we have right now will be looked upon as the worst we have ever had when it comes to actually implementing the laws that we have in place. Plus, we have the bizarre situation that the head of the Consumer Product Safety Commission is saying that she doesn't need more money or more resources to monitor for lead in children's toys and all the other things that we hear about very frequently. So we've got to recognize that right now we need to get a renewal of the laws that are on the books so that situations like we face with atrazine and other compounds will be relics of the past.
All right. Hope that gets at the question of the call. Let's go to another caller here. Sydney, this is line 3. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I would like to hear a brief discussion about whether or not they exist. I have been told that they do, and it being statistical clusters of cancer incidents around nuclear power plants. I grew up in Grundy County, Illinois. And Dresden nuclear plant is one of the first generations of nuclear plants. So I'd like to hear your comments about statistical clusters around nuclear power plants and whether or not the simple existence of statistical clusters has any evidentiary basis in legal claims.
Oh, I'm glad you left this for last. Statistical clusters are very, very difficult to evaluate. Whether it's a cluster, which means by implication it's just a random event, or whether it's a cohort, which means that it has something in common and that's why it all exists, is one of the biggest challenges we face in public health research. Just today, or actually December 8th, it's Saturday, a German study found that children living near nuclear power plants had a significantly higher risk of developing leukemia and other forms of cancer. And the study was done by Germany's own federal government Office for Radiation Protection. That's a little unusual, right? Mm-hmm. You have to understand that Germany plans to shut down all its nuclear power plants by the early 2020s. Yeah. And the German Environment Minister, Sigmar Gabriel, is a former Green. So everything has to be taken with a grain of salt. But the reality is that the issue of nuclear power plant radiation is a very challenging one for which we do not have a lot of well-agreed-upon data, but a number of scientists who are respected are concerned that there appears to be evidence of increased risk of leukemia. I am not an expert on that issue. I can't tell you if they're right, but I cannot tell you that they are wrong. And I think it would be a big mistake to ignore this new German study and many others. The challenge we face in epidemiology, and it's a big one, is that there is a probability of about 1 in 20 that any result is just going to happen randomly. That's the way we do public health research. 1 in 20 chance of the result could occur just by happenstance. when you see results showing the same thing over and over again, you start to think, well, maybe there's something to it. There is now emerging, and has been for some time, a suggestion of increased emissions, but from power plants. But understand this, not all nuclear power plants are the same. They have different technologies, they will have different emissions. This has been, no pun intended, one of the most hotly contested issues in public health research. And I think it will remain so for quite some time. I'm afraid I can't answer the question beyond telling you it's a really tough one to answer, and there have been a lot of vested interests that have ensured that we haven't even been asking the right questions. I hope that we've now reached some maturity as a civilization, that we can afford to ask this question in a way where the answer, whatever it is, will guide us into formulating better policies than we have in the past.
Good enough.
All right, thank you. Just real quick, my apologies, I have a couple of callers I can't take, but I want to ask you about one thing real quick here that's on the list of top 12 ways to reduce cancer, and that has to do with cell phones. Should people be concerned about using cell phones?
Sweden, Germany, and Britain recommend that children do not use cell phones. And they do that because the cell phone specifications, if you read them, say the cell signal, which is a microwave signal, can get 2 inches into the brain, and you can get a heating effect. Leaving aside the issue of cancer for a moment, brains of children are developing rapidly, and they're hot enough. They don't need anything else. But more importantly and seriously, I recommend that you use a cell phone with a speakerphone, if you can, with a wired headpiece or a Bluetooth accessory to reduce the amount of radiation. The current generation of cell phones is certainly less of a problem than the old ones, but a study just released in Sweden last month found that people who use cell phones for 10 years or more had double the risk of acoustic neuroma and double the risk of a malignant brain cancer. So obviously we have to continue to hope the electrical engineers will design these things better, because under some circumstances, cell phones save lives. But clearly it's appropriate to take precaution in how we use them, and they should not be kept on the body on all the time, particularly on the hip, which is where our bone marrow is.
Okay. We'll have to leave it at that. The book is The Secret History of the War on Cancer, published by Basic Books. Our guest, Dr. Deborah Davis. Dr. Davis, thank you.
Thank you very much. PreventingCancerNow.org.